Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. In 1935, Nazi-led Germany strengthened and expanded what was known as Paragraph 175, a law that criminalized homosexuality and homosexual intent as grounds for arrest. Adequate evidence included kissing or embracing another man, gossip spread by neighbors, or receiving a letter from a gay friend. Over the next 10 years, tens of thousands of men were found guilty, and many of them ended up in concentration camps. However, with the victory of the Allies and the defeat of the Nazis, Paragraph 175 actually remained on the books, and persecution against gay men in Western Germany continued, and even at times steadily rose. Today we're going to be in conversation about a book that was published in 1972, originally called The Men with a Pink Triangle. Gay men were forced to wear a pink triangle in the concentration camps. Later, gay rights activists would turn that pink triangle into a symbol for queer liberation. The book was written by Heinz Heger, a gay man who survived the Nazi Holocaust and later the continued persecution by a post-World War II West Germany. My guest for this is David Fernbach. David Fernbach is the translator of a new edition of this book, The Men with the Pink Triangle, The True Life and Death Story of Homosexuals in the Nazi Death Camps. He is also known for his translations of Karl Marx's works, and in the 1980s, he's co-founder of Gay Men's Press. David Fernbach, it is a great pleasure, sir, to welcome you to this program.
Pleased to be with you.
Let me begin just by the name Heinz Heger, because this is a story in of itself. It's a pseudonym. It's a pseudonym for the man's name was actually Josef Kohut. Tell me about why he used a pseudonym.
Josef Kohut was a gay man who survived the Nazi concentration camps, and he did not want to appear in public and to be known not just as an openly gay man, but a gay man who had had this dreadful experience, which still had a kind of stigma to it in the first 20 years at least, after the defeat of Nazism. He told his story to a friend of his called Hans Neumann, fellow Austrian, fellow gay man, also a man who was in the closet, who actually lived with a considerably younger partner for many years, but presented this partner of his to the world as a stepson who lived with him, although no doubt his closer friends, even if they weren't gay, were aware of the relationship. And it was Hans Neumann who recorded and, transcribed and wrote up and edited Josef Kohut's account. Yeah, so it is absolutely a first-person account, but the person who wrote it down wasn't the person who had this experience. And even after this level of anonymity, Hans Neumann still did not publish the book either under his own name. He didn't publish it under his own name, and he didn't publish it until homosexuality had been decriminalized in Austria in 1971. The book was finally published the year after that in 1972 by a publisher in Hamburg in Germany, and very soon sold widely and was recognized as an important, almost unique testimony of the sufferings of gay men in the Nazi years. And us in the English-speaking world and the gay liberation movement that's sprung up and blossomed in the 1970s, both in the United States and in Britain, became aware of this testimony and of other writings about, third-person writings about the Nazi persecution that began to appear in German. And so when Aubrey and I started Gay Men's Press, a small publishing company, in 1980, this was one of the books immediately that we thought we wanted to make available to English readers.
It's just striking to me how even after 1971, when Austria's version of Paragraph 175 was really when homosexuality was no longer criminalized, that even in come 1972, for a gay man, and again Hans Neumann, who you pointed out also helped write this, two gay men had to use a pseudonym, because it was still dangerous to out yourself as gay.
Yes, it wasn't dangerous anymore in terms of the risk of imprisonment, but for someone like Hans Neumann, who was a middle-aged gay man with a secure, well-established career, it was, I think, you know, those are the kind of risks that very much remained in the 1970s and 80s, perhaps even a bit longer in some fields, that homosexuality was still seen as a disabling factor in many professions and walks of life.
In my introduction, I talked about this law, paragraph 175, that was not invented, not created by the Nazis in 1935, but strengthened and expanded. This paragraph 175 actually goes all the way back to 1871. But what I found interesting and actually important is during the Weimar Republic years, homosexuality was, I wouldn't say accepted, but becoming more accepted. You'd have gay clubs and things like that. And this anti-gay fervor was actually very much part of this, the rise of the Nazis, wasn't it?
Okay, well, this is an important and interesting topic, etc. And I completely agree with you, but let's unpick it and go into a little bit more detail.
Yeah.
I would then say that even before the Weimar time, if you go back to the 1890s, to the last years of the 19th century, that there was already a move to decriminalize homosexuality and therefore an underlying awareness or belief that there was nothing inherently wrong with homosexuality, that was already spreading and taking hold as early as the 1890s. And indeed, a year or two after the Oscar Wilde trial in England, 1895, which made such a mark on public consciousness, in Germany, a committee called the Scientific Humanitarian Committee was founded, and that was the first committee to campaign for law reform, for the legalization of homosexuality. It did that legally, or did that openly, let's say, right from the 1890s. And the Social Democrat Party, which was the mass workers' party, already with 20 to 30% support among the population, the largest German political party, although never in government until the 1920s, the Social Democrat Party, under its leader August Bebel, B-E-B-E-L, presented to the Reichstag, to the German Parliament in 1897 or 98, a petition for the abolition of paragraph 175. Now, this was not accepted, it was rejected, but you can see that there was a wellspring of support already for legalization right from the 1890s. And in fact, the German authorities on the whole were, although the politically it was still impossible to legalize, to abolish paragraph 175, the application of it was fairly lax. The feeling of the police was often that this was a blackmailer's charter, that it didn't do any good. It just drove homosexuals underground. And in fact, the number of people who were convicted of under paragraph 175 remained very small. And there were already homosexual clubs and associations before the First World War, not in the scale that there were in the 1920s, but they were the first shoots of that, particularly, of course, in Berlin, being a large cosmopolitan metropolis. And as you say, there was a very booming gay scene, particularly in Berlin by the 1920s. I mean, English, I don't know about Americans, but English writers like Christopher Isherwood and Stephen Spender and W.H. Auden all spent time in Berlin and were attracted there because it was seen as like a mecca for gay men in Europe at that time. Mm. Yes?
A mecca.
So this is not quite as straightforward as you might think. Yes. The origins of the Nazi Party, or let's say the movement out of which the Nazi Party grew, were from the front soldiers of the First World War. Young men who had been brutalized by the conflict, who resented greatly, tremendously, the fact that they had been defeated. Their mood was completely different from the mood of their counterparts among, say, British or American troops who had won the war. Yeah. So they were, right from the start, I mean, hostile to the democratic government and regime and constitution that came into being in Germany in 1919. And at first, there was a move that their focus was to try and restore the Kaiserreich, the empire, to try and bring the Kaiser back. The Kaiser had scarpered off to Holland and had no intention of coming back to Germany and being attacked. And so gradually this idea of to replace the democratic constitution with an authoritarian, right-wing, militaristic, racist, anti-Semitic regime. Anti-Semitism was always there in the right wing in Germany, and it became especially, Jews became especially a scapegoat for the Nazis, even before they were called Nazis, at the end of the war and in 1919-20. And this SA, they were first called the Freikorps, the Free Corps. These were like soldiers who, after the armistice, which ended the First World War, had gone to fight in the Baltic provinces, which had been part of Germany. And then many of them came back to Berlin to put down left-wing opposition to the New Order in Berlin, where the even before they were called communists, radical socialists who had made the revolution that overthrew the Kaiser, they didn't just want to overthrow the Kaiser, they wanted to overthrow the military and other reactionary authorities and establish a socialist economy, etc. And they were brutally put down by these volunteer soldiers, the Freikorps. And in this, the word male bonding is quite important. In this sort of freebooting, violent soldierly ethos, there was a strong male bonding ethos. And homosexuality, while not on the surface, was often not far beneath it. Yeah. And out of this Freikorps became what once the Nazi movement had established itself organizationally in the 20s was called the SA, the Sturmabteilung, or Storm Division. Yes. And this was very much what had grown out of the Freikorps and continued right up to the Nazi seizure of power to be their brawling, street fighting, armed paramilitary wing. And the Freikorps, the Sturmabteilung, the SA, was headed by Ernst Röhm, yes, R-O-H-M, Ernst Röhm, who was homosexual, who made little secret of his homosexuality, and who indeed helped other gay men of his particular tendency to rise to positions of authority in the SA, yes? Now, we'll just cross over to what was happening in terms of law reform in the late 20s now, because the movement for law reform, which, as I said, had already started in 1898, and this petition to abolish paragraph 175 was repeated in the German parliament several times before the First World War. And in the 1920s, it it had strong enough support in the Reichstag that it was, the Reichstag voted to send it to a committee to debate, etc., and discuss the details of it. So it was almost as if paragraph 175 was going to be abolished. But it was this was the time when the Nazis, wanting to capitalize on all sort of right-wing trends that there were in the population, and particularly the sort of Catholic and Protestant conservatism that was still very strong, particularly in the provinces of Germany, they took a strong stand saying homosexuality was an evil that should German people shouldn't allow itself, should always be illegal, should always be criminalized. And just at that time, the homosexuality of Ernst Röhm was disclosed in the newspapers, letters of his were published, and there was this big scandal, and the left started to play on it and say, this shows what the Nazis are really like, they're a gang of queers, etc., especially the SA. And so you get the beginnings of a left-wing attack on an attack on homosexuality by the very people who, very social and political forces who had been for legalization. But the Nazis at first tried to brush off and say, oh, these are the SA, they're sort of, don't expect them to behave like a gaggle of schoolgirls, you know, these are men doing men's things. But eventually, the Nazis had to clamp down on this homosexuality in their own ranks. And this was the purge, so-called the Night of the Long Knives in 1934, after they had come to power, when Röhm and his friends were killed, and a lot of other dissident Nazis as well. And Hitler and his gang assumed total power from that point on. And that's after that paragraph 175 was greatly amplified by 175A, which widened the scope of what you could be prosecuted for, even to, you know, kissing, or if a photograph with a loving inscription was found on the back, as happened to the author of the Memory of the Pink Triangle, you could be arrested and imprisoned just for that. And the years 1937 to 39, for those 3 years, there was a particular campaign to round up and arrest homosexuals. It became, for the Nazis, a big thing, more than it had been in their first years. And about 90,000, it's estimated, men were arrested in those years. About 30,000 were sent to prison. Joseph Kohut, the author of the pseudonymous Memory of the Pink Triangle, was arrested at this time. And he was arrested in Austria, which became part of the German Reich in 1938. So it was just after that that he was arrested. Even so, there was only the incriminating evidence against him was only a photograph. He was sentenced only to 6 months in prison. As he said, in the prison, he was treated okay. But rather than being released from prison, and this is what happened to the thousands of other gay men in prison at that time, he was sent straight to concentration camp. And he describes the horrific experiences that he went through in concentration camp. And within the concentration camp, the gay men, distinguished by their pink triangle, together with the Jews and gypsies who found themselves there, were at the bottom of the heap. Whereas the criminals, with their green triangle, and the political prisoners with their black triangle were the ones who were, let's put it this way, less brutalized, not quite to the same extent. And insofar as the SS, like in any situation like that, relied on trustee, what we call in England trustee prisoners, I don't know if the word is the same in America, you always have to rely on selected numbers of the prisoners to help to keep the others in order, to organize things like food preparation and distribution, to organize the work details, to organize the dormitory arrangements. You always rely on other prisoners to do this. And these were called capos in the concentration camps. And it was almost always the criminal or the political prisoners who were the capos. The author of The Memory of the Pink Triangle, Joseph Kohut, he survived while so many of his fellow gay men didn't by establishing or agreeing to sexual relationship with a non-gay man, a criminal, one and then another one.
So talk to me more about Joseph Kuhut, his experience as a gay man in a concentration camp. Sexuality is a part of this. Rape is a part of this. There's this very, you know, very vivid description early on in this book of when he's going to the concentration camp. He is with two other prisoners who are criminals, who are murderers, who raped him.
Yes, I mean, this was par for the course in that situation. Let me say that also that one aspect of the mistreatment of gay men, in particular in the concentration camp, was constant humiliation. Now, within the concentration camp, no one had a name. The prisoners could only be referred to or refer to themselves or each other by their number, yes. But the gay prisoners, when they had to sort of report and say, you know, number so-and-so, they weren't even allowed to say that. They always had to say, ass fucker, number, and give their number, not just number, etc. So this was a constant humiliation of them within the concentration camp system. But what I want to say also, which should be made clear, is that after the fall of the Nazi regime, the specifically Nazi legislation, like paragraph 175A, the extension of the anti-homosexual law, though that was immediately abolished, you know, throughout the German territories. Paragraph 175, as we said, remained in existence. And believe it or not, well, let's remember that homosexuality was a crime not just in Germany, but in the Allied powers as well, the victorious powers. In America, in the Soviet Union, in Britain, homosexuality was a crime. And those gay men who were in the concentration camps, who had been sentenced, say, for imprisonment of 2 years, but after a few months had been sent, as I think they directly were later on, to concentration camps, they were released from concentration camp, but they were sent back to regular prisons to serve the rest of their sentence. This happened in West Germany and in Austria. I don't know if it happened in East Germany. So this is the terrible irony. Of course, to be in prison seemed like heaven after being in a concentration camp, but it still, of course, not only was a horrific experience, but marked you in civilian society as an ex-prisoner, you know, who had been in prison for a crime.
Is that what happened to Joseph Kuhut?
No. He was, because his original sentence had been 6 months in prison, he was released right away at the end of when the camps were liberated. But there were many hundreds, if not thousands, of gay concentration camp prisoners who were transferred for the remainder of their sentence to regular prisons in Germany. And this is under the supervision of the liberating authorities, American, British, and Soviet.
What was the reaction to the publication of the book, The Men with the Pink Triangle?
It was one brick in the wall, to one step in expanding awareness about homosexuality, not just present, but the experience of gay men in the past. And I think, of course, particularly after the war, when all the horrors of the Nazi crimes were exposed, there was very little at all coverage in the media or in academic work about the persecution of gay men at all. This only came much later, I would say, really only started in the 1970s, a quarter of a century later, because of the continued criminalization of homosexuality in the victor countries. Yeah. Finally, but in the 1980s, this was the time when the English-speaking world, the Nazi persecution of homosexuals became publicly known and accepted. This wasn't just the case with gay men, although it was particularly because the Holocaust was seen very much as, you know, the mass extermination of Jews, the mass extermination of gypsies, which was on a comparable scale, was even now far fewer people are aware of that, for example, or of the Nazi extermination program of disabled people among the Germans themselves, which started before the Holocaust, but was only stopped because of the opposition it encountered among among German families. So the rule and the fact that 3 million Russian or Soviet prisoners of war, who should have been treated like prisoners of war, died because of mistreatment by the Nazis in prison, in the camps, in the concentration camps. So, I mean, the scope of the Nazi Holocaust was its full extent. You know, it still needs, people still need to be aware of that. And I think, hopefully, we can say that mainstream public opinion now in America and in Britain is aware that it extended to homosexuality. But, you know, books like The Memory of the Pink Triangle certainly have an important part to play in rubbing that in.
David Fernbach has been our guest. David Fernbach has joined us for a conversation about the book, The Men with a Pink Triangle, The True Life and Death Story of Homosexuals in the Nazi Death Camps. David Fernbach was the man who translated this book into English. David Fernbach, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you.
Thank you, Rich.